The next scheduled KANU News will be at 10 o'clock tonight. It's 7 o'clock and you're tuned to Public Radio KANU Lawrence. Public Radio KANU now presents A Feminist Perspective. This series provides a forum for women to speak publicly on issues of concern to them. Here is the moderator of A Feminist Perspective, Emily Taylor, Dean of Women at the University of Kansas.
Good evening. Welcome to Feminist Perspective. The purpose of these Monday evening programs, as the announcer has told you, is to offer a forum for women to speak publicly on issues of concern to them. We also wish to inform other women and men of the movement which is remaking the shape and substance of women's and men's lives throughout the world. Our format consists first of discussion by our guest panelists on a topic of interest and concern to women, and second, an opportunity during the last 15 minutes for listeners to participate by calling with comments or questions. Our number is 864-4530. Due to technical difficulties tonight, and for tonight only, we cannot broadcast your questions or comments. However, someone will take your questions and comments and relay them to us, and we will try to answer them for you. This series is sponsored by the Dean of Women's Office, which functions as a women's resource and planning center. We invite you to call our office at any time if you wish to discuss a matter of concern to you or if you wish further information. Better yet, come in person to talk or to use our constantly expanding women's library in 220 Strong Hall. Our topic tonight is Women in History, and our two panelists are Greta Minsky, student of English, and Beth Lindquist, graduate student in the History Department. I understand, Greta and Beth, that together you taught an LAS course last semester on this subject. Did you find much interest in the subject?
Yes, there was quite a bit. Our enrollment was closed soon. There among men as well as women, though we only had one male student in our class, but there seemed to be a growing interest among women in discovering more about their history, which they feel has often been denied or denied them. So it was a valuable experience for us, I think.
Beth, when did you first get interested in the subject?
Well, I came to women's movement out of one of the typical approaches coming out of concern for greater reform issues, and I found my place being thwarted and stopped at many levels through male leadership and power. And secondly, I came to it through my academic studies in history. I had an interest in the long-neglected history of women, and thesis work and research seminars and this type of thing led me to a more academic approach to the study of women's history.
And do you recall, Greta, at what time, if at any time, you noticed in history books themselves or other historical writings that women were treated any differently from other definable groups?
I don't know exactly when I first noticed it, but it was brought home to me again in one of the readings we did for our class, Virginia Woolf's The Room of One's Own. She talks about going to the British Museum, looking through historical studies, and finding histories of civilization where there would be four entries for women, their place, their role, whereas she could never find that type of listing for men or for mankind. And her objection to the generic use of the word man or the generic use of mankind was really seemed important to me. And I started thinking after that of the very few instances when women were mentioned in history, and always their contributions were cataloged in specific areas such as the home, or certain women were presented as models if they were acceptable as uplifters or as homemakers or as wives of famous men, but generally their contributions as innovators were neglected.
We had quite a bit about queens, don't we? If they're famous in that way.
I would say this comes a lot out of the nature of historical studies up until, say, the early 20th century. It's dominated by a lot of political and economic discussions, and then you would come to the great leaders like Elizabeth or Catherine. Since the turn of the century, there's been an increased interest in social history. And in this area, you come into studies of the family, of childhood, of women in social situations, in working situations, this type of thing.
We also have the question of the history of the women's movement. Would you like to comment on that? I'm especially interested because I keep running into people who think the whole movement toward equality for women was started in 1968 or January of 1970. I've heard that time mentioned too. When did it really start?
Well, I would say for the American experience, people usually go to the year 1848 in the Seneca Falls Convention. There were earlier movements in the 30s and the 40s in the 19th century. These centered around women coming out of abolitionist crusades. The real spur to the women's movement after 1848 was, of course, the Civil War period, when women did have an opportunity to work outside the homes to volunteer their services. There were also splits at this time, developing more in the 1870s, between the women of the New York faction. This is Susan B. Anthony and her associates, who wanted reform and suffrage along with other social questions resolved, such as better working conditions for women, this type of thing. And then there were the suffragists who were concerned only with the vote at this time. Of course, this split really became final during World War I period, when Alice Paul and her group formed the Congressional Union.
You want to comment on that, Greta?
I was just thinking of the only earlier instances I can think of that many people are familiar with. Mary Wollstonecraft's book, A Vindication of the Rights of Women, published in 1790, was generally conceded to be one of the founding impetus of the women's movement, though it wasn't really much understood or discussed until the mid-19th century women's campaign in England and America. But she's always fascinated me because growing out of her concern with human rights and the kinds of Enlightenment ideas about freedom and religion, freedom and that she had, that she wasn't taken more seriously at the time that she was writing.
What kind of reception did she get? Did very many people read what she wrote? Do you have any idea about that?
She wasn't that widely distributed, though her ideas did filter down to the mass population, I'd say, at a wide level. But she was generally regarded as a crackpot, and much later historical writing has dismissed her this way also, saying that she gave no good analysis of the women's movement or of any prescriptions for change. And yet she was the first woman to really bring the situation to the concern of the intellectual public. And for that reason, I think she deserves to be remembered.
Would you classify her as a crackpot?
No, I wouldn't.
Why did they say that?
I would say, basically, she came upon the heels of Thomas Paine and Declaration of Rights of Man. Many conservative middle-class groups considered her statements as being in the revolutionary tradition of, say, Declaration of Rights of Man out of the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. So she was not legitimatized in this way. However, later in the 19th century, when people like John Stuart Mill came out in favor of women's suffrage and right to work, her credibility rose.
One interesting thing about Mary Wollstonecraft is she's always dismissed as being the product of a bad home environment, and she rebelled against her ordained role of social passivity because she had a bad relationship with her father or an idolatrous, you know, relationship to him. And it's interesting that this should be used to dismiss her, because I find very little evidence for that.
Do you feel that we still have some of this? We've already had a question called in. The listener wants to know why are white women so crazy? Now, he declined to define crazy or to discuss his intent in emphasizing white. I presume he thinks that we're all white and also crazy. Do you find this very common anymore? People taking this attitude? Go ahead. Press your finger on the subject.
I would say white women are no crazier than white men, maybe a little less crazy than certain white men we know.
Are black women more crazy than black men, or white women more crazy than black women, and so forth? This is a form of stereotyping, too, isn't it?
Absolutely, I would say that.
I know. Many crazy white men, white women, and black women. That's about as far as I can go on the subject of craziness going to any particular ethnic or social group.
Let's not confine any particular group of people. Well, let's probably shouldn't face you with that with this question, but since someone saw fit to ask it, I guess we could give him some kind of an answer to it. Let's talk a little bit more, though, about what was happening in the history of the United States, at least, that would give some notion to why there was an interest that developed even in the middle of the 19th century. What was happening in the country at that time that would make it any different from any other period of history?
Well, I think one point that has come through as an important reason is as the frontier moved westward, women were still confined to agricultural and home roles, and they had been doing this for a longer period of time, so that popular sentiment seemed to say that this was an eternal role of women, the child raiser, the nurturant roles. And any departure from this was then viewed as something as crazy, as a radical split, whereas in actuality, women had had many different roles before this period of time and perhaps wanted to regain some of those earlier roles.
Do you know anything about the history of voting in our country? Was there ever a period in parts of the country, at least, where women at one time did vote?
Yes, in the United States, it wasn't until 1699 that the first restrictions against voting and holding office were applied to women. And this process wasn't completed by all of the states until New Jersey finally revoked women's right to vote in 1807. So we had an early period where women were given a great deal of freedom, and similarly there weren't as many laws against married women owning property or engaging in occupations.
So the voting was actually then a question of property owning rather than the fact of being a man or a woman.
Right, this is a similar pattern in Great Britain. Although we do want to stick to American experience, it was not until the Reform Bill of 1832 that women were taken off allowance for voting. And when it did pass later, after the turn of the century, still maintained some property restrictions. I suppose the second period of the voting struggle came with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, when people like Garrison said to the women, wait, you have helped us with emancipation, we will help you later. This is the Negro question now. Hold off. Of course, this lost some women from the abolitionist struggle.
They weren't all willing to wait.
Right.
Then it really isn't true that that women entered the economic life of the country at some given period of time. They were always a part of the economic life of the country, is that what you're saying?
Yes, I would say that. The women, the working women on the frontier, had as an important role as the man as far as being a producer. They would care for the gardening and the clothing. Periods of the Industrial Revolution, people always cite as being one of the watershed years for women's progress. Factory work, productive labor of this sort, forced women out of the home. And then the inequalities of wages and working conditions came to the front, of course.
And then there were also women who chose to work, who many early American novelists were women. Someone has estimated approximately a third of all novels published in America before 1820 were written by women. This was one of the few areas which was open to them as something they could do at home and something that perhaps didn't require an extensive technical education, but used the types of training that women had, such as training in recognizing and evaluating emotional states and trying to interpret them. So women have been prominent in other areas, even though they haven't always been recognized for them.
You know, Carolyn Byrd tells an interesting story about that. The early decisions in the garment trade as to what was to be a man's job and what was to be a woman's job. Just very arbitrary arrangements. It could have been the other way around. Whatever the various divisions of labor are. But once they were decided that something was to be a woman's job, then the price, of course, was put a great deal lower than it was for the ones that where the decision was that those would be men's jobs.
Speaking of the women's garment group, one of the third big periods of feminist revival is in the period of the 1890s when the women's trade union leagues developed and the women's consumer leagues. And these were for protection of working women. They were mainly middle class in leadership and concern because they, of course, had the free time to struggle for their sisters in the working class.
What's the time period for Fiorello, do you recall? You know, Fiorello, the musical comedy, it dealt with the efforts of women to form a union. That too was connected with the garment trade, as I recall it. But that wouldn't have been quite that early, would it? I like to remind the members of the radio audience that we do welcome your questions and comments, even though tonight they'll have to be relayed to us. But I assure you that we'll make an effort at least to answer or comment on anything that you care to say. Do you have any comments on the individual women in American history that you feel have been sort of passed over by historians? Are there any individuals that come to mind? That
there's so many. In the field of, well, starting off with one woman who made a big impression on me, Ann Lee, was a an American woman, well, actually an English woman who migrated to this country and started the Shaker movement. And women in religion have often been overlooked. And her ideas of communal living, common property, and celibacy for both sexes were kind of a historical anomaly. But she also had the idea that the of a dualistic deity, which would have two manifestations, Jesus having been the male manifestation, and eventually she predicted that a woman would come to present the other half. And I always thought she was an interesting person.
Where'd you read about her?
Robert Regal wrote a book called American Women, A Study in Social Change, and attempted to document many women and their contribution to American life.
One of our listeners wonders, does there seem to be any correlation between social revolutionary reform movements and reform movements in women's rights? Any comment on that?
Well, it seems in the past that there have been a couple periods that has followed. As I mentioned before, the period of the 1890s was a period of social unrest and ferment, a period of beginning socialist ideas in America. An individual woman who comes to mind in this context is Charlotte Perkins Gilman, of course, and she was a very fine socialist writer and thinker, wrote a book, Women in Economics, and she also had an equally strong interest in women's problems and questions. She was one of the first to come out against the Freudian interpretations of why women, you know, assert their power and this type of thing. Seems like in social revolutionary movements, when women become involved, their interests and their desires come at the end. And this is also a similar pattern when reform comes through, that women's changes are made after everything else has been dealt with, after the working hours have been restricted, after working men's compensation has come through. They think, well, maybe we should tack on some suffrage amendment or something like that.
Mm-hmm. This is a listener thinks he sees a correlation in Chinese history. You know anything about Chinese history? Or?
Well, I would say that seems to be the case since, I don't know, my vague remembrances of studying the Long March and Mao's rise have been always an emphasis placed on women as producers, women outside of the home. I don't know, the accounts I've read, women are encouraged to take jobs, to put off marriage, and to be socially productive as well as men. I don't pretend to speak about Chinese history with any authority, however.
Mm-hmm. All right.
That's been true in the European experience that I've seen. Revolutionary movements such as the Commune, which is my interest, 1871, women had an active and strong position of leadership and also in rank and file groupings, and much voice.
And there might be other kinds of correlations between social reform movements that really didn't have anything to do with women and the progress of the women's movement. Are sometimes the same kinds of mistakes made.
Right.
As someone said recently, every reform movement gets a case of the sillies every now and then, and this is not confined in any way to the women's movement. It happened in the labor union movement. It's happened in all social reform movements. Our number is 864-4530. Lest we run out of time to say this, I do have a couple announcements to make, and then we could go back to a further discussion of this issue. Next Wednesday on the campus, there are two programs that might be of interest to many women, or two men too, perhaps. One is the Faculty Forum in the Westminster Center. The subject is the February Sisters, Why? Bev Price from the Women's Coalition will be there to discuss this subject. And secondly, that afternoon from 1 until 4 o'clock, the Commission on the Status of Women has another one of its career browsing sessions in the Dean of Women's office in 220 Strong Hall. Those who are interested in exploring various career possibilities, and especially in these days it becomes increasingly important to bring any ideas you have on vocational selections up to date, it would be a good idea to come in and check out the literature and talk to someone about it. Also on Thursday at 7 p.m. on the same station, KNU, Marlene Sanders' speech, which was given at the Spring Symposium of the Commission on the Status of Women, will be broadcast. Now, the reason I put those in at that time is that, gee, sometimes I run out of time before I get a chance to say it, and I understand there's a basketball game tonight, so that won't be possible. So if I can redirect your thinking now to the question of women in history, are there other things in the few minutes that remain that you think should be mentioned? We haven't talked, for instance, about why, and I might ask you this question, why do so many people believe that, or seem to believe that the women's movement is something that started in this last decade?
Well, most would say that in history that you read, being written largely by men, various reform movements have been left out. Research has not been done. Sources are just coming to the fore. The nature of historical studies is just changing now to include more groups. I hesitate to say it's a systematic leaving out. I don't have any great conspiracy theory or anything like that, but I think it must be said that it is following more interest in reform movements in general. And here again, women are categorized, sadly, but at least some of the information is being relayed.
Also, I think that there's been kind of an interval in the women's movement between the vote, gaining the vote in 1920 and the resurgence of interest in the 60s. There was a period in which women were told that their responsibilities were first to become liberated sexually, then their responsibility was to go to work in the factories for the war effort, then their responsibility was to go home and raise the children who supposedly were turning increasingly to juvenile delinquency and other problems. So that we have had a period in which women were not generally thought of as feminists, though there has been a feminist consciousness, I think, throughout those years.
With few people, of course, always continuing to work on it, but you're certainly right that those of us who lived through part of that period at least recognize how women were pushed and pulled in and out of the labor market kind of at will, particularly when we were at war,
right,
where then it was terribly important that women go to work, and one was made to feel very guilty if she didn't. And then when the war was over, she was supposed, of course, to go back home and made to feel guilty if she wasn't doing something very different from what she'd been made to feel guilty for not doing a few years before. I would certainly want to thank our panelists, Greta Minsky and Beth Lindquist, for their contributions tonight. Next Monday, our subject is sex role stereotypes. And our guest panelists will be Professor Betty Banks and Ms. Loretta Blana. Thank you for listening.
This has been A Feminist Perspective. We hope you will join us again next Monday evening at 7 o'clock for this live program.